The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 213, a paper entitled Mormons, Movies, and Romantic Eschatology, with presenter James McLaughlin, and a response by Scott Denhalter.
Well, good morning and welcome. We'd like to welcome you all to this Sunstone Symposium. It's Friday, July 29th. Today you are in session number 213, which is entitled Mormons, Movies, and Romantic Eschatology. Briefly, just a little bit of housekeeping rules. Please turn off all pagers and cell phones and other noisemakers. Mom, if you could turn yours off, please. We also would like to remind you that that admission is by name tag or ticket only, and if you haven't purchased a ticket, it can be purchased from the registration table. It says that's very important. My name's John DeLynn, and I would like to introduce our speakers today. Our first speaker will be James McLaughlin. It says here that James received his PhD in the philosophy of religion from the University of Toronto. He is now professor of philosophy at Western Carolina University. He is the author of many articles on contemporary philosophical issues and movements, including personalism, which we learned about yesterday, with a special emphasis on W.H. Chamberlain, Mormonism's most famous personalist philosopher. Which may or may not mean a lot to some of you. And he also likes to study process theology and existentialism. After James speaks for about 30 minutes, and James, do you prefer like a 5-minute warning or a 1-minute warning? Okay, I'll give you a 5-minute warning. After James speaks to us, the respondent will be Scott Denhalter. Had a brief chat with Scott before we started. But Scott is a writer, a translator, a bibliophile, and he's also the Cyber Saints editor for Sunstone. And he's also a gopher for a he works for a subsidiary of Living Scriptures. One of the owners. So without any further ado, let's turn the time over to James.
Hey. We're going to watch movies in here. Yeah,
my fault. I didn't get the movie machine. I should have thought about that. I could actually show some movies.
You can storyboard.
Yeah. Actually, what I'll do is I'll act them out for you.
Yeah, good.
Jim, you might want to hold the mic while you're doing this.
Well, I'm just going to write something on the board. Oh, okay. I'll talk loud enough. Chalkboard dependent, or whatever this board is. What do they call these?
Whiteboard.
Okay. What I'm going to talk about a lot in my talk is something called the circuitous journey. This is This is from M.H. Abrams, who taught at Cornell for a long time. He wrote a book called Natural Supernaturalism on the Romantic Movement. And in it, he talks about a circuitous journey in which we start at what I'm going to call unconscious unity. And we move from unconscious unity into plurality and alienation. And then, hopefully, I'm going to put a line there because not guaranteed that you get here, you get, at the end, to conscious unity. Or the one and the many. I guess what we could do here is just say the one, the many, And what we want to end up at the end is with the one and the many. Now, I'm going to use movies to illustrate this and talk about how I think Mormonism, Mormon eschatology, or we're going to talk about what eschatology is similar to this kind of romantic eschatology. Let's do that. Let's start out with reading a couple of quotes. One is from Plato, and the other is from the Book of Mormon. Okay, so I'm skipping around in the paper a bit. How many of you, you know, staying up late at night, have ever watched Richard Simmons? Is he still around? There was a time in my life when I was kind of an insomniac, and I watched a lot of old movies on TV and watched Richard Simmons in the middle of the night because it was funny. But remember, Richard Simmons would talk like, you know, there inside every, you know, robust person, there's a thin person trying to get out, and that's somehow the real you. Okay. There are vestiges of Platonism there. And it's funny how you can think Richard Simmons and traditional theism at the same time, but they are related. Nietzsche once said, we'll believe in God as long as we believe in grammar. And what he meant by that is there are these vestiges of this old Greek way of thinking that we find all over the place. And what that old Greek way of thinking was that the absolute truth was something up here in the unity of the one. It was eternal. It was unchanging. It was perfect. Like, you know, you think of and it's a good place to start with the human body here, because in Plato's dialogue on love, he starts out with the human body. It's the lowest way to think about love, according to Plato, from that term platonic love. You know, it's non-bodily, it's purely spiritual. Even there, at the lowest level, there's a way to think about love as in this eternally perfect way. Now, what I'm going to be claiming is that's exactly the way Mormons don't think. That's exactly the way that, matter of fact, I think it's the way we shouldn't think. And I think there are significant reasons for that. But I'm going to read you a quote from Plato's dialogue on love called The Symposium. Now, Plato, you know, he's a great thinker. There's all sorts of other things going on in Plato in this, but this is the way Plato was taken by a good deal of the theological tradition. And I think that Nietzsche was right, that in many ways, I don't think this is true about Mormonism, but in many ways, Christianity has been Platonism for the masses. Okay, now I'll have to explain what that is later. But let me read this quote to you. What if man had eyes to see true beauty, the divine beauty? I mean, pure and clear and unalloyed, not clogged. That's how he says this. Not clogged by the pollutions of mortality and all the colors and vanities of human life. Thither looking and holding conference with true beauty, simple and divine, remember how that in that communion only, beholding beauty with the eye of the mind, he will be enabled to bring forth not images of beauty, but realities, for he has not hold of an image, but of a reality. And bringing forth and nourishing true virtue is to become the friend of God and be immortal, if mortal man may. Now, let me explain what happens in the symposium a bit, how we get to what he's talking about. Say I look at I'm a lustful human being. Okay, let's use Playboy. Okay, I know Mormons don't read this magazine, but you consider Playboy, you say even here, you know, you have this intimation of Platonism, because as you look at Miss June, okay, you see the ideal human form. Or, you know, if you'd rather, Michelangelo's David. I'm going to, I would act things out. I don't look much like David, but, y'all seen David? Sorry. No hair either, yeah. As we look at Michelangelo's David, we see an ideal human form. And yet, as we know, all individual instantiations or incarnations of that form are going to change. I mean, Miss June 1953 probably isn't, I guess Playboy wasn't around in 1950. Well, you know, you get the idea. Probably isn't looking like she did in 1953. And even Michelangelo's David eventually will disappear. So as we move, he says, we move from this ideal human, from this mortal, material instantiation of the ideal human form, but that points us to something more perfect. Like, say I fall in love with my wife because I think she's physically beautiful, but I also am attracted to her spiritual characteristics, her intellectual characteristics, her character. But even there, it's only an instantiation of that. For Plato, what I really love is not my wife, it's her virtue, okay, or various virtues. Then so I move beyond all of those until finally I enter the realm of pure ideals. And see, the advantage here is anything in this world will die. It will fade away. Whereas when I arrive in the eternal realm, it's changeless and eternal. Like, give me an example.
Actually, it's not, right?
Yes. A square is, we know what it is. It's a geometric figure with four equal angles and four equal sides. And if we measure, we can even just look at this and see that it's an imperfect example of a square. Just like I'm an imperfect example of Michelangelo's David, or the ideal human form. Now, so just like Miss June is an imperfect example, because remember, she's been airbrushed and cleaned up in a lot of ways and posed, and she doesn't look like that. None of us look like that. So the idea here is that one thing about this is that it's imperfect. The other thing about it is it can be destroyed. But the concept of the square is still in our minds. It's eternal. Okay? Now, what Plato's saying is that's what we should love. Okay? Now, I think Mormonism gives us almost an opposite approach. And I want to read to you well-known scriptural passage from the Book of Mormon. For it must needs be that there is an opposition in all things. If not so, my firstborn in the wilderness, righteousness could not be brought to pass. Neither wickedness, neither holiness, neither misery, neither good nor bad. Wherefore, all things must needs be a compound in one. Wherefore, it should be one body. It must needs remain as dead, having neither life nor death, nor corruption nor incorruption, happiness nor misery, neither sense nor insensibility. Wherefore, it must needs have been created as a thing of naught. Wherefore, it would have no purpose in the end of its creation. Wherefore, this thing must needs destroy the wisdom of God and his eternal purposes, and also the power and mercy and justice of God. And after Adam and Eve had partaken of the bitten fruit, they were driven out of the Garden of Eden to till the earth. And now, behold, if Adam had not transgressed, he would not have fallen, but would have remained in the Garden of Eden. And all things which were created must have remained in the same state which they were after they were created, and they must have remained forever and have no end, and they would have had no children. Wherefore, they would have remained in a state of innocence, having no joy because they knew no misery, doing no good because they knew no sin. And Adam fell that men might be, and men are that they might have joy. Okay, now how does that relate to Plato? How is it the opposite of Plato? That's what my paper's about. Okay. As we get into the paper, I'm going to modify a lot of things in here. I'm just going to talk about it. Take the Adam and Eve story from, if we were making a movie, okay? Take that from the Bible. And think of the ways that we talk about this. And the term for this often is, for this story, is eschatology, which means the last things. Apocalypticism is a type of eschatology because you're talking about the last things, the end of the world. But also you can talk about eschatology as the end of the world meaning the purpose of the world, the purpose for which it was created. You know, to what end do I do something? Okay? So basically in Christianity there have been two types of eschatology. And it's not just, I'm not just talking about Christianity here. I do world religion, so we could even throw in Hinduism in some ways. But one is that, but let's not muddy the water. Let me back up and forget Hinduism for a while. Let's just do Adam and Eve. Okay. One way of talking about the Adam and Eve story is you have a fall. You have a fall from original perfection. The fall is just a fall. That's why you talk about original sin. It's absolutely bad. There is nothing good about it. God made the world perfect as it can be. And you and I, in the persons of Adam and Eve, screwed it up. Okay. Now, what will happen is God will come back and restore the world to its perfection, and that will be the end of the story. Okay. Everything we do here in no way affects that perfection. God is absolutely perfect because God is beyond space and time. That's traditional Christian, Muslim, and Jewish eschatology, although there are heterodox traditions within Judaism, Christianity, and Islam that have always gone against that. Another version of eschatology. But see, the question we're asking here is the question, is God plus the world greater than God alone? Or is God plus the world no greater than God alone? In traditional eschatology, because you're thinking about God like you're thinking about that square, the fact that it is instantiated here in the world makes no difference to it. Affects it in no way, because that would change it. And to change it would make it less perfect. The Romantics did something else. They talked about God plus the world being greater than God alone. And I think that's what Mormonism does as well. Here, the world has a purpose with God that is realized through the radical transformation of the earth. The world is transformed through human labor, through evolution, through moral transformation, all kinds of things like that. And to talk about this, I want to use some movies. And the one that is the easiest to think of right away is the one that I'm sure we've all seen. At least I hope so. The Wizard of Oz. Anybody here not seen The Wizard of Oz? Good. I'm also going to talk about Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, Harold Ramis's Groundhog's Day, Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and I'm going to throw in one opera. Wagner's Siegfried. Any opera buffs out there? Yeah! Okay. Anyway, if we go back to 2 Nephi chapter 2, you can see it in these terms. And let's use Wizard of Oz first because this is the one we're all familiar with. We start out in an unconscious unity. Remember, Lehi says there, the world would remain as one, as dead. Now think of the beginning of The Wizard of Oz. And this is the way to think about that passage in Genesis chapter 1 where the face of God is over the deep and God hovers over the chaos. Okay. The chaos is just that, pure chaos. It's purely potential, but there's nothing there. It's incredibly boring. Eternity, that's one of the things I love about Mark Twain. Mark Twain wrote this one wonderful story on Captain Stormblower who goes to heaven. And the problem is heaven is an incredibly boring place because nothing happens there. It's eternal. There's no change. Okay. But in Wizard of Oz, we start out in that most boring of states, Kansas. And not only do we start out in that most boring of states, Kansas, we start out in black and white. This is another great film here. If you've seen Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire, the angels in that film, or if you had the misfortune of seeing City of Angels, they missed the whole thing. But in Wim Wenders' film, the angels see the world in black and white, whereas human beings are in color. Yeah, this is a great thing. Well, so Dorothy starts out in black and white. But she wants to move beyond this. She wants to go over the rainbow. And once we get to Oz, we're going to see Oz is in color. That somehow going to Oz is an improvement over the original Kansas. Okay, but as we'll see, she's alienated in Oz. This is not her home. She wants to go home. But as we go home, this is the thing, God plus the world is greater than God alone. It's a different Kansas. It's black and white again. I think that's a misfortunate thing. But it's a different Kansas she goes home to than the Kansas she left. And love has an important role to play there. Okay, but let's talk about Groundhog's Day for a minute. There's a one of the great romantic philosophers was a fellow named Friedrich Schelling, and there's a common contemporary Slovakian philosopher Slavoj Žižek. One of the great names, huh? Slavoj Žižek wrote a book on Schelling. Schelling's a particularly difficult philosopher to read, and he wrote a book called The Irreducible Remainder, and he explained Schelling using Harold Ramis's Groundhog's Day. And he says, in Groundhog's Day, you get a perfect example of this, moving from the unconscious unity of one through alienation to conscious unity. And we start out in eternity. That's where, Phil Connors, Bill Murray is. How many have seen Groundhog's Day, by the way? Good. We got the right group of people here. He's in eternity. He is the traditional notion of God. Remember, there's that one point where he's talking to Andy McDowell after he's tried to kill himself a million times, and he says to her, "I'm a God." And she says, you're God? You can't be God. I'm not the God, but I am a God. And then later he says, well, maybe I am God. Because he's stuck in eternity. He knows everything, but nothing is real to him. Remember, all the people in the town, they just come back, nothing is real. Žižek says this about it. He says, the Schellingian dimension of the field resides in his anti-Platonic depreciation of eternity and immortality. As long as the hero knows that he is immortal, caught in the eternal return of the same day will dawn again and again and again. He bears the mark of the unbearable lightness of being, of an insipid and shallow game in which the events have a kind of ethereal pseudo-existence. He falls back into temporal reality only when, and precisely when, his attachment to the girl grows into true love. Eternity is a false, insipid game and an authentic encounter with the other, in which things are real, are for real, necessarily entails a return to temporal reality. So here, what Schelling goes on to say is that time's actually better than eternity. Now, let me qualify that, because when Mormons talk about eternity, we never talk about eternity the way other people do. I remember this was one of the big shocks for me when I actually went and studied, was that we use all these words, God, eternity, omnipotence, and we mean different things than everybody else. Like, for example, eternity. And for us, it's always endless time. I think that's a good common sense way to look at eternity. I go up to heaven, everybody's there, we're there forever, the party goes on. For most Christians, Muslims, and Jews, eternity is timelessness. Okay, time is a fall. What Žižek's saying about Groundhog's Day and what Schelling's saying about reality is, no, time is a step up. Because in time, we actually encounter other people. They're real other people. They change. We have to change with them. And that's what a love relationship is about. So it's a very different conception of love than we've got in Plato. Let's go to to Wings of Desire and to Siegfried. Wings of Desire is such a great example because they're the angel played by Bruno Gans, Damiel, falls in love with Maria, I guess is her name. Every time he touches her, he enters color. Okay, and he gives up being an angel to enter into a world where love can really happen. Now, what's interesting about this, and what's wonderful about the film, is the Bruno Gans character, the angel Damiel, is such a cool guy as an angel. But when he enters the world, he's kind of a dud. But it's better being a dud than it is living in eternity. My favorite example of this, and if some of you were in my workshop, I beg your pardon, but I love to quote this line as often as I can, is in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, because this is also a problem in Eastern thought. You know, the perfection of the one versus the imperfection of the many. Now, not everybody in Eastern thought thinks that way. One of the problems we often have is reducing religions down to one idea. Religions are really diverse. In Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, you have this contest going on. Remember, how many of you have seen Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, by the way? This is such a great group. If you haven't seen it, go out and see it. This is one of the greatest movies ever made. And it has the single greatest romantic line since Wuthering Heights. Okay? And that's when Mu Bai is dying. Remember, the monk. And he hasn't been able to enter Nirvana because he's attached to the... I can never remember. Michelle Yao character. I can't remember her name. And he's in love with her. And he can't become one with everything because he loves her. Her. You know, that's really important. You know, if she becomes one with the universe, she's not as cool as she is if she's her. And he's dying. But he's trying to meditate to slow down the circulation of his blood. And he's finally telling her what he's never told her his whole life, is that he loves her. And she says to him, don't waste your strength. Save it for your meditation. And he looks at her, and this is it. This is the greatest romantic line almost in the history of cinema. I have wasted my whole life. I would rather wander eternally as a hungry ghost by your side. A hungry ghost in Chinese religious mythology is a being that doesn't go to heaven. It's a being that's stuck here on the earth, okay, that has to be bought off with spirit money or it will bother you. See, that's why Wuthering Heights, because remember Heathcliff says he doesn't want Kathy to go to heaven. He wants her to haunt him. You know, good stuff. Okay, but he said, I would rather wander as a hungry ghost eternally by your side than to enter paradise without you. Okay. Anyway, Siegfried, the same thing happens. Brunhilde, when she sees Siegfried, she gives up being a god and becomes human. Because it's better to be human and to be in love than it is to be a god. Okay, let's see. How much time do I have left, though?
8 minutes.
8 minutes. Okay, got two-thirds of the paper left. But we'll we'll summarize. Okay. The second move here, okay, so unconscious unity isn't so great. We've already talked we hinted a little bit at what conscious unity is. Let's talk about alienation, which is really the second move here. And the origin of evil. In the main portion of 2001, A Space Odyssey, we move from, how many of you have seen 2001? This is such a great group. You know, if you haven't seen it, go see this. This is one of the greatest movies ever made. We start out with the monkeys. They're not conscious. They're afraid, everything. And then all of a sudden, the monolith appears, and they become creative. Little monkeys sitting there, remember, and they start playing the music. Da, 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 da. And he's, you know, playing with the bone, and all of a sudden, he goes, cool. It's not a bone. It's a tool. And I can kill people with it. Okay. Kill animals, and, you know, it's will to power, Nietzsche stuff. Then, remember, after he kills his enemies, he throws it into the air, it turns into a spaceship. So what we've got here is a fall from unity into plurality and alienation. You get it in Wizard of Oz when Dorothy goes to Oz. Get it in 2001 because there are no real human relationships in 2001 after you leave the apes. You know, you have on Clovis when they have the meeting, the big wig there. These are all technicians. Everything's being reduced to, you know, how do I manipulate the world? Okay. A really great example of this is the character Phil Connors in Groundhog's Day. He's a weatherman. I think that's significant. He's, you know, wants to manipulate the world. He wants to be in control of things. Later, when he thinks he's a god, after he's, you know, entered eternity, the world isn't real for him. But what he discovers is being a god is not such a great thing, if you think of God that way. To be in control of everything, you know, means you can't love anything. Okay, everything, you are the only real thing, and everything else is not real. And love requires that there be real others. Now, the example I always use of this is, how many of you have had teddy bears? There was a certain point. I remember, you know, you watch Mr. Rogers, you know, remember that song? Sometimes I hold my teddy bear tightly all night long. You know, he's still, I get scared, it goes on, he's still strong, all this stuff. He's old, but he's still strong. There's a certain point, though, when teddy doesn't work anymore. You remember what that is? It's the point where you realize when you're holding teddy and teddy is saying to you, you are so wonderful, that you realize you're only talking to yourself. Okay? Now, in Groundhog's Day, see, that's the problem. Nobody there is real for Phil Connors. It's already been that way before. He wants to be a little god. He wants to control the universe. Nobody's real. It's only when he enters time again at the end that they become real. Now, if you take this in Mormon terms, all we have to do is think about the battle in heaven, where the two plans are presented. What Lucifer's plan is no one will be real but me. But that's a lie. It's a lie from the beginning, because we were all real from the beginning. This is one of the great things about Mormonism, that wonderful plurality, where God actually requires the world. Okay, 5 minutes? Or 3 minutes? Can I have five? Okay. One of the questions I asked in the paper is, but if God is essentially love and moral goodness, why is there evil? Is this truly the best of all possible worlds? In Schelling's and in Lehi's eschatology, there is only one possible world. For that reason alone, it is the best possible. God is a living person, and to be in a situation with other persons is to be in the real world. Evil happens because we are free, because chaos exists, and we're trying to bring that chaos to order. For example, the wonderful passage in Alma 42, verses 13, that's repeated again in verses 13, 22, and 25, that it seems that it would, when it says, if mercy were to rob justice, God would cease to be God. It almost seems that it is possible for God to do it, for God to make us be good, but if God were to do that, God would cease to be God. And why is that? Because God would have to force us. He would have to turn us into teddy bears, into slaves. And God will not do that. This is not to say that with John Hick and other traditional free will theologians that God freely limits his power so we might be free, but rather that it might be possible for God as a person to coerce us, but then God would cease to be God. For God is morally perfect. For God to be morally perfect is to recognize the freedom of other beings. Okay, let me end on a positive note. So I'm going to skip ahead here a little bit, and let's talk about conscious unity. The final step is a return home. It's not a return to the innocence and unconscious unity of step one, but it's to go to a higher and more intense level than that. This may be the significance of the star child at the end of 2001, but the child is alone, so 2001 doesn't quite work for us here. In romantic and dialogical visions, this termination of the quest is usually thought of as a social, and was presented by love and marriage. One of the reasons that the romantics love Shakespeare so much, you know, we all love Shakespeare now, but you have to remember in the 18th century, nobody liked Shakespeare. Voltaire thought Shakespeare was an inferior playwright to Corneille, to the French classicists like Corneille and the French comedian Molière. Now, I don't know anybody who thinks that now. But the Romantics thought Shakespeare was great. And one of the reasons they thought Shakespeare was great was because every Shakespeare tragedy almost ends with people being alone. But every Shakespeare comedy ends with a wedding, a marriage. And this is the great example of the end of the journey. Because in a marriage, you achieve the ultimate reality that Schelling calls the two become one and remain two. So it's a unity that's chosen rather than a unity that is guaranteed by a metaphysical being. I think this is part of the significance for in Mormonism that marriage is the ultimate form of the priesthood. The two become one and remain two. It's also important that they remain two. You know, if you have the one little god there, it doesn't work. This is so. I want to end with just contrasting this with an important piece of Christian literature. You know, Pilgrim's Progress, and there the character Christian, when he goes out on his pilgrimage to the Eternal City, he's forced to leave his family. His family call him back. You know, come back to us, come back to us. He runs off with his hands over his ears. And if you've ever seen the film Inherit the Wind, you remember that scene in the film where the preacher, when his daughter is challenges him, puts his hands over his ears and starts singing hymns. Okay? That's direct reference to Pilgrim's Progress. When Pilgrim puts his hands over his ears and runs away from his family screaming, "Eternal life! Eternal life!" As if, eternity is gained by leaving everything you love here on the earth. Contrast this with the end of section 130 of the Doctrine and Covenants, verses 1 and 2. I'll end my paper with this, where we see conscious unity, or heaven, is the eternal community. It's not God by himself. It's an eternal community living together. Everybody's a god. When the Savior shall appear, we shall see him as he is. We shall see that he is a man like ourselves, and that the same sociality exists among us here will exist among us there. Only it will be coupled with an eternal glory, which glory we do not now enjoy. So, kind of like the party goes on forever. Thank you.
I understand that that Abram's circuitous journey is more profoundly a model of human psychology, and I think there's some very thought-provoking notions to that when we apply it as a description of the Mormon concept of eternal progression. We as mortals do seem to have a predisposition to desire to be God, and as Jim has pointed out, how happily that leaves us will depend upon how we define God. If we are prone to the Platonic model and wish to somehow abrogate the not only freedom but also chance in this world in an effort to, through fear or anger or whatever the motivation might be, but fall prey to the temptation to control our lives and to control those in it. And in controlling them, they become less real. They become strictly objects. Rather than other real subjects within our purview, but there is also the possibility that we can understand what Christ teaches and move toward adopting the Isaic model of God, that of the suffering servant, one who does not seek to control but merely to persuade through his own good choices and behavior. It's a difficult, of course, it becomes the more often the road less traveled within this life. In looking over Jim's paper and thinking about it, it's kind of caused me to meditate on the possible deeper meanings of some aspects of Mormon theology. Before I head in this direction, which is kind of a little tangential, I do want to mention the film Reconstruction, Christopher Bohm's Danish film Reconstruction, in which the main character, Alex, is in love with not his girlfriend, but with the selfish pleasure that love brings him, that heady euphoria. Because of this, time is his enemy, because that euphoria fades. He meets a new woman, a strange woman that he just sees, glances at casually, who, as chance would have it, gets on the same train as he and his girlfriend, Simone. This new woman is named Amé. And at first, you don't notice it, but as the film progresses, you realize that it's the same actress who is playing both parts. And therefore, what Alex ends up chasing is always the same woman. He leaves his girl, his girlfriend Simone, and he begs off, makes some lame excuse, and pursues Amé. And the morning after he has spent the night with Amé, he finds that time has in fact suspended itself, kind of in almost in the Bill Murray in the Groundhog Day sort of situation, except not that there's this endless recurrence of the same day, but that he has actually stepped from one universe into another, where the memory of Simone and all of his former friends connected with Simone do not remember him, and he does not. His apartment no longer exists. His friends think that he's a lunatic. And so he has to pursue, again, he has to pursue this woman, Amé. And as chance would have it, he is ready to meet Amé and run away with her to Rome one night and sets up the appointment. And he stops by a bar, which he frequented in the old life. And he sees in the bar Simone. And Simone has seen him before and doesn't, you know, knows that this guy's a little crazy, but she's attracted to him and she doesn't know why. And suddenly he's tempted again to pursue this selfish pleasure of the romantic love. And he lets the time pass. When he finally returns to Amé, it is Amé who no longer recognizes him or knows him. And the narrator at the end of the film has him walking down the street. And you realize, and he basically informs you that in pursuit of both women, he is now alone. And there are people on the street, and the narrator says, "Not like this." And then the people disappear. And he is alone walking down the street. And he says, "Yes, like this." He says, "Now this is just a film. This is just a construction. But it still hurts." It's a fascinating film. And I think falls in line as one of the more accessible illustrations of what Jim has been talking about here today. I've had some rather errant thoughts and musings on this, and I wonder if I'll ask some questions. Is LDS in LDS scripture? There's a lot of a lot said about both light and darkness, and I wonder, is it possible that in Mormon thought of light and darkness that can be seen? I wonder if how good a fit is the concept of outer darkness for Schelling's Ungrund, which Jim mentions in paper and then he doesn't mention today. But this would be darkness at the simplest level of particulate or waveform existence, without motion, without temperature, undifferentiated, dispersed equidistantly, and without relation to one another. Thus, a multiplicity without unity. Now, this question does quibble a bit with Abrams' description of chaos as a conscious unity. It would allow chaos to definitely be conscious or unconscious in both the particulate and in the aggregate, but it could only be seen as a unity in its endless sameness. Having no relational unity, it is potentially everything and yet no thing. LDS scripture, in LDS scripture, light is equated with such synonyms as intelligence, truth, glory, and the Word of God. Joseph Smith taught that light has always been in existence. And light, then, as the antithesis of darkness, would be the most complex level of particulate or waveform existence, possessing motion, temperature, differentiation, consciousness, and a relational unity. As darkness is a multiplicity without unity, then light would be a unity with multiplicity, a demonstration of the divine community, if you will, on the subatomic level. As such, light can be organized into coherent substances arrayed from the refined to the gross, and which is commonly mistaken in mortality as the dualism of spirit and body. But it struck me that possibly outer darkness is this the one, and then through an investiture of power, God persuades, through an act of persuasion, I shouldn't say through an investiture of power, but somehow through an act of creative persuasion, is able to take discrete amounts of light and move them into a plurality, such that now they have a dynamic velocity, these particles or waveforms. They are, in fact, what we would deem light. I don't just mean the electromagnetic spectrum. But it is then from that plurality that God can build and make greater structures. These structures, as each of these structures increases in its complexity, whatever is being organized from them, then each possesses a higher and higher state of consciousness and a concomitant increase in its ability to move from being to becoming. In other words, taking that first step toward godhood. I realize that what I'm doing here is of course speaking literally about things that would best be presented in the flexibility of mythos. Nevertheless, they're not the ravings of a gospel hobbyist. It's really Jim's fault. Jim, the paper you gave me bid me partake, and I did eat. Nevertheless, I'm really only attempting to flesh out for myself this notion of the circuitous journey, for I believe it makes for reasonable answers to such questions as to the true nature of God and the problem of evil. Jim's done a fine job. Did a fine job in his workshop Wednesday to expand upon those greater themes, and I greatly appreciated being there. One thing that seems clear to me in all this is that Mormon thought has the potential to be what Jim describes, but I think that it has not yet divorced itself sufficiently from the Platonic ideal of perfection, which has so deeply and unalterably molded traditional Christian theology. In Jim's Wednesday workshop on existentialism and Mormonism, a class member asked, who would want to become a god? Assuming the definition of God, of God given by traditional theism, the answer would be, no one who wants to be happy. And assuming instead a definition of God as a perfectly loving being with reasonable limitations, the answer might be more easily in the affirmative. Thank you.
We'd like to thank both James and Scott for their presentations. We do have about 9 or 10 minutes for comments or Q&A. So we'd welcome any of you to come up. And please come to the microphone so that the digital apparatus can capture.
I couldn't help but think of a paper I heard many years ago. Gil Bailey of the Temenos Institute talked about God's greatest invention that he thought was clever because he was alone. Because he didn't want to be alone. He wanted friends. So he invented death. And that began the process of creating friends, which I think links into some of the things that you've presented here. I'm quite stimulated by that, and I couldn't help put those together, and I think that's a really good idea.
I hope death isn't permanent.
it's like your murder.
Okay.
Not there, and we don't know about it, so it's a creative invention.
Oh, okay.
That allows us to get motivated.
Okay, yeah.
To be afraid, to make mistakes, to stumble all over things, but to get real.
Okay, I see what you mean. Heidegger in Being and Time talks about what makes us authentic human beings is to realize that we're going to die.
Yeah.
Gabriel Marcel takes that in a different direction and says, no, it's not so much realizing that we're going to die, it's realizing that everything we love is going to die. And I like that second one because, you know, it does give a certain urgency. As Alma says, this is the time where we've got to get this stuff done because, you know, we can't put it off. If you're going to love, you're going to have to love here. Something that Scott said I thought was really interesting is that I didn't talk about, and I don't think I even ran into it here, he drew this conclusion, is the idea of return to the Ungrund would be associated with outer darkness. And that's true. You know, this is the one place that I think Brigham Young and Bruce R. McConkie and these guys really come together is that, you know, to be a god is, in the traditional sense of trying to control everything, is to return to chaos. Because if everybody wants to be God, then hell is other people, as Sartre says. You know, because they're all getting in front of my project of being God. So, anyway, I really appreciated that. Thanks.
Any, you know, words of abuse? Anything like that?
I have a very tangential question. So you'll have to forgive that. I'm not even a novice philosopher. I'm just a beginning mini philosopher. But yesterday when Brent Metcalf spoke, were either of you at that session on Mark Hoffman? His basic conclusion, I'll just summarize so you can have the context. His basic conclusion that I got from it was that we sort of hold God up as this being that can intervene and prophets as these type of special people that can help be conduits to that intervention if they're doing their job right. But because God didn't intervene as he had hoped he would in the Mark Hoffman instance and wasn't able to warn the right church leaders at the right time, to him that was a final death, sort of a nail in the coffin of the existence of God, and he kind of declared that God was dead. Afterwards, we went up and talked to him. And his basic, some people were really uncomfortable that he had arrived at that conclusion. And they sort of said, you know, they tried to convince him that he should change his beliefs. And his basic idea was that he found himself trying to justify God in all the evil that he saw in the world. He found himself working so hard to try to justify God that he realized that in his mind, God was just a creation, that he was creating God instead of God creating him. So I would love to hear a 30-second or however long you guys have, and this is a personal question, how you've sort of reconciled the theodicy in your own personal lives. And in any way, if you want to relate that, if somebody renounces God, where then do they then fall back on this cycle? How do you...
Olga Strindberg, the modernist poet, once said, God has only one excuse, and that is that he doesn't exist. I always thought that was pretty good. I think that we... a lot of atheism... it comes from what Nikolai Berdyaev, one of my favorite Russian Orthodox philosophers, said, from a profound moral source, that you see the world, you see what a mess it is, you look at the traditional notion of God, and you say, you know, we're better off without it. And I'm really sympathetic to that idea. The reason that I don't go the way by the way, I went to high school with Mark Hoffman. He was in my advanced placement history class. Didn't talk much. I always like to tell that story. Karl Rove went to my high school, too. You know, it seemed to be like evil was created there.
You should have gone to West High.
Olympus High School. You know, it's as you walk past it, it's this kind of black hole. Anyway, I'm sorry. I have to answer the question. The reason I believe in God is I believe in God as the community of our ancestors, and God being an ancestor who's just further back there, and God being, as Erastus Snow described God, as both the man and the woman. I mean, as God, as B.H. Roberts described God, as this generic idea of God that all of us participate in. And I there are things that disturb me, like the problem of evil. I go with this idea of completely non-coercive God that I've picked up from process theology and from the Romantics and from... But I think as a Mormon believer, you have to always place what... Potter back there talks about the narrative, the story, over your theories. And in the story, there's a lot of divine intervention. And I have a hard time explaining to myself how that happens, but I hope it's there. But the reason I believe in God is I think not to believe in God is to finally ally yourself with death, and death in the sense of a permanent death. And I can't accept the idea that everybody I love lives on in us as a spectacular memory, because memories fade and they cease to exist. And if for real others to be, they have to continue to progress, continue to change, continue to be annoying. And yeah.
I think that Brent's comments yesterday were a moving and powerful example of a Mormonism that has not been able to divorce itself from its Protestant heritage and its Calvinistic God, impersonal, aloof, and unilaterally powerful, who seems to intervene in some cases and doesn't intervene in other cases, and there seems to be no rhyme or reason as to the motivations of his intervention and non-intervention. And so we justify that God by saying the ways of God are mysterious and beyond our ken. I think that when Mormonism realizes where Joseph was going, and I think maybe Joseph may not have fully understood where he was going, that we do end up more with the God of process theology, a suffering servant who feels a great deal of remorse, and sadness for our bad choices and feels perfectly what we feel, but is helpless to intervene and change what we have chosen through our own actions. And that he tries to persuade us through the whisperings of the Spirit to make better choices that will lead us to greater happiness, but is unable to abrogate the freedom that we have to will what we will. My friend Jake over here told me an horrific story yesterday of a woman who he worked with who lost her diamond ring, and it was an heirloom, a family heirloom, and was not just worth a lot of money, but it was worth a great deal sentimentally. And she knelt down and she prayed, and at some time during the day, the thought struck her, almost as if it were a voice, as to where the ring was. She went straight there, and there the ring was. And it was a great, great testimony to her of God's love and his willingness to intervene in our lives. A few years later, this woman shut her her two-year-old daughter's room, shut the door, assuming that the daughter couldn't open the door and get out. She went to the garage, started her car, and backed her car out over her two-year-old daughter and killed her. If God is the God of Plato, this aloof and unmoved perfection, one has to ask, is a wedding ring more important to God than a two-year-old daughter? The answer has to be no. This God can't exist. And I don't believe in him.
We'd like to thank James and Scott for being here today. Let's give them a hand for their presentations. We'd also like to thank each of you for coming, and we'd like to remind you that these sessions are being recorded and are available for sale in the bookstore area. Thank you very much.